Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today we talk gardening with Roberta Clark, horticulturist and entomologist. If you have questions for us this morning or stories about your garden, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Mindy.
So, you know, we had this nice mix of sun and showers, and now all of a sudden it's gotten a little bit dry.
It has been very dry all over the state, although I think the western part of the state has gotten a little more rain than we have. But I'm already in the regular rotation of dragging my sprinklers around the yard, which is not my favorite thing to do. But at this time of the year, when we're planting new perennials and new annuals and vegetables in our gardens, these plants generally have limited root systems. They haven't developed enough to grow into the soil yet, and they will be the first to wilt. So regular watering, anytime there's less than an inch of rain a week, is definitely a must.
Yeah, and for the new plants that you're talking about, we probably don't want to wait a whole week, right?
You don't want to wait a whole week for a new plant. If you're particularly if you're planting from a six pack, that's a little tiny bitty root system, and it's going to take it a little while to grow out into the surrounding soil and be able to establish itself and get enough water to grow during those periods where it's not getting it adequate water. So I judge by looking at the plant and looking at the soil, and for those areas where I've just planted something, they get watered about every 3 days.
We've got a question from Mark Faraday. He says, I'm seeing serious leaf curl on a number of plants this year, some at least associated with aphids, milkweed, obedient plant, a couple of species of turtlehead. He says he's not noticed in other years, and he's wondering if other people are seeing this. And I, too, have seen it on a few things. Some of my honeysuckle is doing some of that curling. So what causes that, or what could cause that?
A number of things can cause it. If Mark has seen aphids, definitely aphids and other sucking insects. One of the symptoms of that type of an insect problem is that leaves become distorted. They can pucker, they can curl. The way it works is these insects insert their mouth parts, it's like a straw, if you want to think of it that way, right into the cells of a plant and withdraw the plant, the cell contents, and those little areas of the plant then are dead, and it caused deformation of the foliar tissue. So curling and puckering of leaf tissue is one side of sucking insects. One thing I have seen a lot of in my perennial garden are leaf hoppers, more so than aphids, and leaf hoppers are also sucking insects. So, you know, go out there and look. If you see these little very light green things hopping away when you disturb the plant, then that's what your problem is. Or it could be aphids. Something else that will cause that earlier in May, just as foliage was coming out, particularly on some of the hydrangeas, we had two nights where temperatures went down here in my yard, at least. One morning I got up and it was 28 degrees. New tissue that's just come out of a bud is very, very tender, and I've seen a lot of little brown edges and puckering of those leaves that were present when those temperatures occurred. I've had new growth come out since then, so it's not, you know, a real problem, but that's also cold. Temperature damage can do that. There are some fungal issues that can do that, but sucking insects are usually the culprit.
Yeah. Need some advice for your garden? Give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got an email. Can you recommend how best to use soaker hoses? I know the gardens should get 1 inch of water a week. How do you determine how long to run the soaker hoses? And this is from Catherine.
That's a perennial question. When we had the demonstration garden, it's still there at the fairgrounds, but since I've retired, I haven't been associated with it. But we had an irrigation system of soaker hoses. And it's very hard to gauge, for me at least, just what the output of that hose is. And it was more a question of observation based on how dry was the soil when I turned them on and how long did it take for the soil to be moist several inches down. And I judge that by the old-fashioned way of simply digging down into the soil and feeling where the moisture was. I know that's not very scientific, but it gives you firsthand knowledge of how long you need to run that soaker hose to get water penetration down around 3 or 4 inches, because that's where a lot of the roots are. And if you're doing it on a regular basis so the soil doesn't dry out in between, you have a steady moisture. If you let the soil completely dry, it will take longer for that moisture to rehydrate the soil. So it's trial and error and observation.
Yeah. I say, you know, I have I use, you know, indoors, the little thing you can stick in the moisture.
The moisture meter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I, you know, if you're just not sure, I just take that outside and stick it in and see what it is. See,
yeah, you can do that.
It's kind of like the finger test. Yeah.
I prefer to rely on how does it feel.
Yeah. No, it's a good way to go. Marilyn sent us a note. She says, I have a beautiful Betty Corning clematis that we planted about 4 years ago. This year, all the flowers seem to be at the top of the vines, not along the whole plant. Just wondering if next year I could trim the top as it grows to encourage more flowers along the whole vine.
That might cause branching. I'm not sure it would produce flowers along the whole vine. That's sort of how Betty Corning grows. It's a beautiful blue, single flowering sort of clematis. And generally, if the lower part of the stems are shaded, which is actually good for the root system wants to be shaded. They like their feet in the shade and their tops in the sun. They do tend to concentrate their flowers more towards the top. Pinching it back might cause it to branch, and you'd get more, you know, sort of a thicker vine up at the top. I'm not sure if it would promote flowering on the lower part of the vine.
Yeah. Since you mentioned pinching back, there are some things we do want to pinch back, like the asters up until about 4th of July, right? Is there anything
asters,
else we should?
Asters, perennial chrysanthemums. When my baptisia finishes blooming, I whack that more than just pinch it. I whack that back because they get to be quite large. Of course, if you've planted them in the correct location, which I didn't, you don't have that problem. But they do get quite large. So yeah, there are things that I like to pinch back to encourage more blossoms, and then there are those things that I like to sort of prune back a bit after flowering.
Yeah, it's a good time too. Now I'm looking around and I'm seeing parts of my perennial bed that are a little bit, I don't say overgrown, but they're things that are too close together. You know, I put something in, and I go, oh, I forgot that I also have this planted right there as well.
Yes.
So I'm taking little notes, going, okay, move this, and move that in the fall, because it's hard to remember where you planted everything.
It is. I take notes and. And then, you know, in the fall, I forget to do all of that stuff. So sometimes I just go out at this time of year, and if things are seriously crowded, I just don't wait to fall to move them. I do it now. And while we're in this cool weather pattern, which supposedly is going to be changing, this is a good time to do it, although, again, we are dry. So you just have to make sure that you're watering adequately after you move something.
Yeah. Casey in Eastham says, please implore our friends here on the Cape to let a portion of our garden go to flower, then seed. Bring in the pollinators and drive save your seeds for next spring. Hang bundles of kale seed over gardens and watch songbirds feed while sprinkling seeds for the next generation. Good idea.
Sure. That sounds great.
I do that too. Yeah, it's funny. I saved some of my nasturtium seeds from last year, and I wasn't sure they were coming in, so I actually bought a different variety and planted that. And now I have them both growing together. One just
that's wonderful.
You know, took off before the other one. Sometimes I get a little impatient waiting for that.
There are certain plants that in my I have tons of way too many plants in my yard. But there are certain plants that I do not cut back when they finished flowering, particularly any of the composite type of flowers, daisies, cone flowers, black-eyed Susans, things like that, because the birds really do enjoy their seeds. So I do leave those until the seed heads have been pretty much picked over by the birds, and then I cut them back in the fall.
Yeah, I don't even cut them back at all. I do everything in the spring, just kind of rake it all up. So, yeah, it's amazing the amount of birds that you'll get over the winter when you leave those seed heads there.
Yep.
Yeah, Marianne says, our community garden has seen an outbreak of cucumber beetle, and I read they reemerge later in summer. So far, my floating row covered plants have been protected, but they are starting to flower. What do you recommend?
Well, that's a tough one. Cucumber beetle is a pretty serious pest of cucumbers. It damages the plants, also squash. It damages the plants in two ways. The adults feed on both the foliage and the stems. In some cases, some of them carry a bacterial wilt that can infect the plant. They also lay their eggs in the soil, and the larvae feed on the roots. So when you have a bad outbreak of cucumber beetle, you can get some cucumbers, but it basically cuts short your harvesting season for cucumbers. I use spinosad, a product containing spinosad, and because hers are now flowering, she needs to open it up so bees can get in there because they are bee pollinated. Take the row cover off. And I would use spinosad, but I would be very careful about timing. I would go out there either, I'm an early riser, so I would go out there extremely early in the morning before the flowers open and spray, or I'd wait until very, very late in the day and the flowers have closed, and then I would use the spinosad. Spinosad, when wet, can affect honeybees. Once it's dry, it's safe for bees. So you need the bees to pollinate the cucumbers when the flowers are open, so don't use spinosad when those flowers are open. Timing your spray is very important there.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's so important to read the instructions.
Read the label. It gives you the information you need.
Yeah. We need every single one of those pollinators.
Yes, we do. But we don't want cucumber beetles.
No, we don't want cucumber beetles. You're listening to The Point. We're talking gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have two holly trees in the back corner of my yard that I pretty much ignore most of the time. And for a number of years, it got that, you know, that black sooty
mold
on the leaves. Yeah, sooty mold, and there is an oak tree above that. Last year, it did not happen, even though I know it was a lot of people had the problem. And I gave them a little holly tone last year, and they were absolutely gorgeous. They're still look good, but one of them have some yellowing leaves. Any ideas on why?
Yes, hollies, particularly American hollies, lose their oldest leaves in May and June. They're usually the leaves that are more towards the inner part of the branch, now not out at the end, and they turn yellow. They kind of get kind of black spots on them. They just look crappy. And they fall off, and that's absolutely normal. And that usually coincides with the emergence of new growth out at the end of the branches. So if you go out and look at that particular one and see that most of those yellow leaves are confined to the more inner portion of the stems, and you've got nice new growth coming out at the end of the branches, then I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah. And for folks who don't know what the sooty mold is, let's talk about that.
Well, sooty mold is an indication that there's a sucking insect problem. Again, as I said earlier, the mouthparts of sucking insects, aphids, leaf hoppers, scale, mealybugs, are like a straw that they insert into cells and literally suck the contents out. And with many of them, they actually imbibe more of the sugary substance that from the plant than their body can process. And there's like a shunt that diverts some of it, and it's excreted as a highly concentrated sugary liquid that we call honeydew. And it drips down on leaf surfaces, on stems, on cars, on sidewalks, whatever is below the branch or shrub that has the insect problem. And there's a fungus that's called sooty mold that grows on that honeydew. It's not growing on the plant, it's growing on the honeydew. Does this impact the plant? Well, the sucking insects usually do. And the sooty mold, because in some cases it can be fairly thick, can block the ability of the plant leaf, that particular leaf, to photosynthesize. The way to deal with it is to get rid of the insects. Now, you mentioned there's an oak branch overhanging. There was a real problem the past couple of years, I don't know how it is this year, of a Lucanium scale on oak trees. And they are a scale insect that secrete a honeydew. So that's probably where the honeydew came from, and then the sooty mold just grows on it. There's also a little fluffy scale, a cottony, cushiony scale, that lives on holly, and it also secretes honeydew. So examine your plants. If you see these little white fluffy things on the undersurface of the leaves, that's either this time of year the egg cases, or the scale itself, and it can be treated with horticultural oils.
Yeah. And in my case, I just ignored it in the tree.
Well, I ignore it too.
It came back just fine.
Exactly. It's not growing on the plant itself. It's growing on the honeydew. So depending on how thick it is, how much of the plant is covered, it may or may not impact the health of the plant. If it's coming from an overhanging branch of a tree, then that plant that has the sooty mold on it is not really being impacted at all by the insect.
Right. All right. Let's talk to Barbara, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a fine crop of kudzu, and I was wondering what suggestions you might have.
You know, when I got my first sample of kudzu in back when I was working at the Extension Service, I couldn't believe it was kudzu because it grows down south. But we actually do have kudzu in very limited locations on the Cape. It's a nasty weed. We don't have quite the growing conditions up here that allows it to spread like it does down south. I don't know what particular herbicides would be registered for it in Massachusetts. You could go contact the UMass Extension weed specialist via email, or you could contact Cape Cod Extension, talk to Russ Norton, the extension agent. He might give you suggestions as to what materials you could use. I would just try mechanically removing it, which could be a big job.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of it, and it's mixed in with ivy.
Poison ivy?
Boy. No, regular ivy.
Just regular ivy.
Yeah, in that case, mechanical removal may be your only option, because anything that you sprayed that would manage the kudzu would also damage your ivy.
Well, I'm not fond of ivy, but I don't really want the bare spot. Well, I will get in touch with those services and see if they have any suggestions, but or I'll hire some person who's willing to break their back.
Exactly.
Yeah, Barbara, good luck with that. I don't have kudzu, but I have that terrible bindweed, and it just seems to get, spread more and more every year. And really, all you can do, I keep pulling it. It, wraps itself around my lilies and my phlox.
Yes, it does.
Yep. So annoying, but, what can you do? Barbara,
thanks
for the phone call. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Were you going to say something, Roberta?
I was just going to say I had bindweed growing up, my lilies, but the rabbits ate the lilies, so the bindweed isn't there anymore.
Oh, you know, I for so many years, how many times have I said, "Oh, the rabbits are fine. They just eat the clover in my lawn."
No, they don't.
And well, now I'm catching them in. There was one rabbit eating some hosta, and then I noticed the rabbit's back with two friends.
Yeah, yeah. I have Thumper and his entire family of thousands living in my neighborhood. This year, after losing almost my entire vegetable garden last year, I have 7 raised beds, and I've individually fenced each bed in, which was kind of a pain in the neck to do, but, you know, my garden, my vegetables look good. Unfortunately, Thumpers now have eaten almost all my lilies, and they've they've eaten a lot of my hosta. The hosta have come back. The lilies have not.
Yeah. So did they get up into your... They got up into your raised beds?
Yes. It's only raised up 8 inches.
Oh. Yeah, they have not gone into my raised beds at all. And I think probably because there's plenty to eat without having to jump up into the raised bed. I don't know.
Well, I have clover. I have lots of grass. And some days I look out there and they're just, you know, eating grass and clover. But they certainly did a job on my lilies.
That's terrible. That would just make my heart sink.
Yes.
I have so many lilies.
My casablancas are gone. No sign of them.
Oh, my goodness. That's terrible. You know, on the flip side, I have foxglove, which I have, you know, most years. And my foxglove, it's the best I've ever. It's 6 feet tall. And I have no idea why. I've ignored it. But
it has been a very good year for foxglove. I'm in a group on Facebook, Cape Cod Gardening. Great group for those of you who are interested in joining, you know. And many people have posted pictures of their foxglove this year, and it looks like all over the Cape it's a banner year for foxglove. We had a mild winter, so to speak. You know, temperatures relatively mild for us in the upper 30s and 40s for fairly long stretches of time, and we also had a wet winter and wet spring. So those are good conditions for the seed germination, and they grew beautifully. Of course, now we're dry, but...
Well, you know, this winter was great too for usually my sage and thyme. By the time spring comes around, they're a little peaked. They are just booming this year. I mean, they both look so healthy and really, you know, kept their size, if you will. Of course,
my rosemary lived over the winter outdoors.
It did?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mine
did
not.
Big plant now. It looks great.
Wow, that's great. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So some things we could be pruning now, right? The lilacs have bloomed. So has the forsythia. Those are things we can start cutting back if we want, right?
The sort of rule of thumb is for spring flowering shrubs, the ones you've mentioned, but also rhododendron and azalea, you want to prune them immediately after they finish blooming. So most of the weigelia is in that category, although my weigelia is in full bloom right now. So if it needs cutting back right after it finishes, I will cut it back. Also, my nine bark is getting a little bit large, so I'm going to be pruning that. That's in full bloom right now. So anything that blooms, you know, in spring and early June is blooming on old wood. For things like the white flowering hydrangeas, butterfly bush, you know, the summer blooming shrubs, you prune those earlier in the year. They bloom on new wood.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing which I have not noticed, and I have a ton of this year, is pokeweed. I might have one or two, but all of a sudden I'm finding pokeweed all over the place.
Yeah, me too, and I'm not happy about it. It's it becomes a quite a large plant with a tap root. And mm-hmm. if you see seedlings that are fairly small, they're very easy to pull out. But if you wait until it gets big, and I speak from experience, it's mm-hmm. got a taproot that goes on forever, and you can't get it out, and so it comes back next year.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been using a shovel to dig some
exactly.
of this stuff out. Yeah,
you know,
it's terrible.
If it's growing in sort of a back area, I do have one area, the side yard, where it's just a weedy overgrown area. I don't actively garden in that area. I go out there occasionally and weed whack it. There's one particular pokeweed that gets quite large, and it's a fabulous looking plant when it's in bloom, and the berries are absolutely gorgeous. So I leave that one. The birds seem to enjoy the berries, although for humans, pokeweed itself, when it's a mature plant, is a toxic plant, so you don't ever want to eat those berries.
Yeah, and you can. I think you can eat the leaves when it's young, right?
That's a poke salad. Yeah. That's what they used to call it. Yeah. I never have. I tend to buy my greens at the store or grow them rather than wild forage, but some people enjoy doing that. I just want to be careful, you know, not to encourage people to go out there and sample things that they're not sure what they are. There are plants out there that if they're ingested, they're toxic, so be careful.
Yeah. Right. Talk to Daniel, who's calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Daniel.
Yes. Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning.
Good morning. Interesting your comments about the rabbit. For the first time in 40 years, I gave up after last summer and this summer, put a fence up around the whole garden because the rabbits were so bad last year, and it made a difference.
I have
a question about basil.
Yeah.
Oh, it does make a difference. I've planted basil from flats that I get from the garden shop every year. And this year, as in a couple of other years, the first couple of nights that they've been out overnight, something is eating them. I don't think it's slugs because they're not whole, but some of the leaves are just completely eaten down to the stems. I've got a couple of, you know, pans out with the beer, and I've caught slugs overnight, a couple of successive nights, but it doesn't look like slug damage. I wonder if you have any thoughts.
This is when the leaves are still fairly small.
Yes, the plants are small. You know, they were either six packs
from the garden center.
Like
sure.
Yeah.
It could be earwigs, which eat young seedlings, particularly zinnias. If any of you have ever planted zinnias and gone out and found your leaves chewed, it's probably earwigs. But you're saying the entire leaf is consumed rather than being just...
Yeah, almost down to the stem, right.
Yeah, that sounds more like a critter of some sort than an insect.
Really?
Is your fence large enough so a chipmunk or a squirrel can get through?
It's 1-inch chicken mesh, so yeah, a chipmunk could squeeze their way through. A squirrel, maybe yes, maybe no, but
or maybe go over.
Perhaps. It's funny. Well, I mean, the basil seems to be the only thing that's eaten to that degree.
Yeah. You know what you might do in the future, and I find this is handy for a lot of things. A really great tool to use in the garden when plants are getting established is floating row cover. And many garden centers will carry it, or it can be ordered from places like Johnny's Selected Seeds. It's lightweight. It floats on top of the plants. I actually use very thin aluminum hoops that I put over the bed and put the row cover on top. And it really does a fabulous job of preventing any kind of critter and insect from getting in there and munching on your young plants. The other thing that could possibly be eating your basil would be a cutworm, although sometimes they go more for the stem than the leaves. I would suggest looking into getting some row covers.
Would rats eat basil?
Rats are a problem on Cape Cod, yeah. And they're a problem in our gardens. I have not determined yet what they particularly like. They seem to be general feeders. So, yes, it's possible they could be eating the basil.
Yeah,
it's funny because, I've got a lot of other stuff put out, and the basil is the only thing that seems to have this particular kind of damage.
Yeah.
I've seen some holes in some of the young collards and things like that that were the slugs, and that was clearly slugs. You know,
yeah.
It was just a hole in the leaf, but this is the whole little leaf has gone sort of down to the stem.
Yeah. That happened to me last year.
What works against earwigs?
Diatomaceous earth.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
Sprinkle the plant and repeat it after it rains or a good irrigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Daniel. Good luck. You're listening to The Point. We are talking gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. If you have some questions or need some advice for your garden, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have Carl, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Carl.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
We had a very large tree that died, and that left us with a very big hole to fill. We filled it up with good quality dirt, and I planted a ton of allium in there. When they were about 6 inches tall, they were eaten to the ground and didn't show a sign of life again for the rest of the year. Next year, I built some enormous construction around it, and they gave tons of pretty flowers, and it was so ugly that I didn't want to do that again. This year, I sprayed abundantly, I'm afraid that may be the problem, with deer away or whatever. And the deer didn't come, but the plants, the leaves wilted. And right now, we have one very sickly-looking plant, flower. Is it possible that I killed it?
It's probably just been weakened because for 2 years in a row, it's not been able to photosynthesize because it's been eaten by something, as you suggest.
No, the second year it made beautiful big plants.
Yeah.
Beautiful big flowers, but I put that enormous ugly thing around it and over it.
Yeah, it's probably just declining. I haven't had a lot of good luck with allium myself. Did something eat it this year, or you used repellent?
I used repellent, and the repellent worked. It didn't get eaten, but after a while, the leaves just wilted, and now they're almost totally gone.
Yeah, I would. I'd probably fertilize it and keep your fingers crossed for next year and use the repellent fairly early. It's probably been weakened and just needs a couple of years of good growth to recover.
Okay, so you don't think I killed it with the repellent?
No, I don't think you killed it.
Okay. So it should be good next year.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you
good
very
luck.
Much.
Yeah, I actually plant. I have some allium that I just had a couple, and I planted more this year, and mine did fine. I had no trouble. They're really interesting looking plants, aren't they?
The flowers are gorgeous. The foliage, before the flower stalk emerges, the foliage looks good. But as that flower stalk emerges and the plants begin to bloom, it's normal for the foliage to turn yellow and die back. Mm-hmm. So you end up with just this tall stalk with the giant flower on top of it. So it's often recommended that you plant something sort of in front of it to mask that foliage as it declines. But they're very interesting plants.
Yeah. Interesting in flower arrangements, too.
Oh, yes, very much so. And you can dry the seed head and continue to use it in flower arrangements.
Yeah. Well, we know how everyone loves their hydrangeas. And some good news, I got a press release this week that the Cape Cod Hydrangea Festival is happening. It's July 10th through the 19th. There's 25 gardens that will be open, which was some good news for people who like to visit gardens.
I think it is. You know, I'm sure they're being encouraged to attend the festival and go to these wonderful gardens. But you know, social distancing and face masks.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. And I'm sure they'll limit the number of people going through it
at any one time.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. All right. Yeah. So Peter in Yarmouth says, when is the best time of year to transplant iris? And what other advice would you have for the transplanting?
Generally, iris is transplanted in the fall. You basically cut back the fans and dig up the, I'm assuming he's talking about bearded iris with the big rhizomes. And you dig them up sometime in September, late August and September, and transplant them. The key is those rhizomes want to be up close to the surface, if not exposed at the surface of the soil. So a common mistake would be to bury them too deep. So they're very shallow, right on the surface of the soil, and the roots actually grow sort of out of the rhizome down into the soil. So you can move them in the fall, they'll be fine, or you could move them in very early spring before the fan leaves begin really to get a lot of growth.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you're talking about the Siberian iris, that every, what, like 3 or 4 years, you have to divide that or it kind of dies in the middle.
It dies in the middle, but while continuing to expand outside,
yeah,
so you
edges.
End up with like a giant donut that's 6 feet across.
So
I have one.
Yeah, I used to have a lot more. I only have a couple now.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I don't want too much to dig up. And the other thing that you don't want to plant too deep are the peonies.
Oh, no, definitely not. They'll grow, but they won't bloom. The eyes of a peony want to be about 1.5 inches, maximum 2 inches below the soil. And if you're mulching your perennials on a regular basis, take into account the depth of the mulch. You can inadvertently end up with your peony eyes too deep in the soil, and then they won't bloom. They're blooming right now, and they're absolutely gorgeous this year. I've got about 5 or 6 of them, and all except the one that's in too much shade is looking absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
great year for
peonies. It's funny. I have 5 of them, and they're all white. I don't know how I ended up with all white peonies.
I love white peonies. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
I have all different colors.
Yeah, I need to, I guess, get rid of a couple white ones and get some variety in there along with the white ones. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're past the point now where we really have to worry about the winter moths or gypsy moths, right?
Neither of which was a big problem this year. There were some isolated spots. But in my own yard, even though I saw what I thought was more moths around Thanksgiving, I did not see appreciably a lot of caterpillars this spring. The plant that I use is sort of my plant to monitor is my Asian pear, and it bloomed beautifully. I've got pears forming. My blueberries have lots of fruit, and those the first few years of, when I had the winter moth, I'd gotten no fruit. So, I mean, I found a few, but they've pretty much ended their life cycle for the year. Gypsy moths, if there are any, I have not seen any, usually go to the end of the month, early July. Mm-hmm. That's when they pupate.
Yeah, but like my apple trees were great. I think I saw 1 or 2 of the winter moths, and you know, a couple of years there was 1 year I had literally 1 apple, and
yep.
Another year 0 apples. Last year I had lots of apples, and it looks like this year is going to be the same.
I think they're pretty much. Dr. Joe Elkington of the UMass released in a couple of different places on the Cape the parasitoid fly that had been shown to bring them their levels under control in Nova Scotia. He released those in several locations here on the Cape about a decade ago, and I think they've really impacted the population levels.
Yeah.
So it's looking good. I think.
Yeah, that's a good thing, yeah. Irene in Wellfleet writes, could you suggest anything related to the new invasive viburnum leaf beetle? What to do for completely defoliated shrubs? Should we just water them as much as we can, and is that all we can do? And for next year, from what I've read about it, the only pesticide treatments are very toxic ones. Would something like spinosad work on this beetle larvae? Seems that the best and only treatment is to search for shrubs for the egg masses and cut them off. Is this true?
You can go onto the UMass Extension website, and there is a fact sheet on the viburnum leaf beetle. You can probably go on the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension website, and they also have the same fact sheet. And it explains the life cycle and management. However, there are some viburnum that are not particularly affected by this beetle, and then there are others that are just devastated by it. So the easiest thing to do, well, maybe not the easiest, but the most logical thing to do would be not plant those that are affected by it and plant the ones that are not. That being said, if you've got viburnum and you have the beetle, I believe spinosad is effective against the larval stage. So familiarize yourself with the timing and the life cycle of this particular pest and then apply the spinosad at the appropriate time.
Yeah. Margaret writes, the UMass Soils Lab closed before I could get the soil tested for a new perennial area. I added some compost and plant tone when I planted the seedlings back in late April. My soil testing meter tells me the soils are still depleted in all three elements, but I've also read that new perennials shouldn't be fertilized while getting established. The plants seem to be growing steadily, but very slowly. Some have flower buds, others still vegetative growth. I can fertilize and water individually, but please advise.
She used plant tone when she established the bed, is what I believe what she said, mm-hmm. And I think that's probably adequate. You know, the first year that you're establishing a perennial bed, you really can't expect the plants to look particularly huge right away. If you've over-fertilized, then they will, but that's not necessarily good. Slow and steady is frankly a better approach. Some perennials do not bloom the first year that they're planted. They will bloom the second year, so I'm not sure I would worry about that. You know, you could continue to use some plant tone. It's a nice slow-release, natural-based fertilizer. I think the more important thing is maybe, you know, mulching and getting rid of weeds and irrigating during dry periods. It should be fine. It sounds like she's doing a good job.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've had this issue with impatience for a number of years now, and we've been saying probably not a good idea to plant the impatiens. Is this still happening? Was it a fungus or a mold? I can't remember exactly what it was.
Downy mildew.
Downy mildew.
It's a down, which is a fungus. Don't plant the regular impatiens because of that. I just don't plant it. It's not one of my favorite plants, and since I have limited space left, I go for those things I really love. But a lot of people really love them. They're beautiful in the shade, one of the few plants that do grow well in shade. But that has been a serious issue in the past. I don't know how bad it is, but I think you do want to be careful. If you want... You can try it, but I wouldn't do extensive plantings mm-hmm. of regular impatiens. I think I'd go more for the New Guineas, which don't get it, mm-hmm. or substitute something like a wax begonias or other shade-loving plants.
Yeah, those wax begonias, they survive in just about anything, don't they?
They're cool plants. I think they're underrated. I really like them. I think they're very pretty, and the foliage is pretty, too. It's shiny.
Yeah, I like them too. This year I've added, you know, I already have a lot of lilies, but I added more lilies. all different kinds, and they bloom
I love
at all
lilies.
Different. Yeah, and they I'm so happy that we don't have that issue with the red lily leaf beetle anymore. you know, I guess we have it a little bit. I haven't seen any in my garden. And as a matter of fact, of all my lilies that are, you know, not all of them are blooming, but I have two where the leaves have just all turned brown, and it almost looks a little wet. And I'm wondering if I didn't get in and get the weeds around it out soon enough, and maybe that's what's happened to a couple of them. But they seem to be doing
great. It starts with the lower leaves and works its way up the stem. Yeah, that's a little leaf spot that is enhanced by wet conditions and poor air circulation. So keeping weeds out and promoting good air circulation and being careful when you water, either timing your watering earlier in the day so it, you know, dries off as the sun comes out, will help that. The lily leaf beetle, another example of biological control. We released a whole bunch of parasites of the lily leaf beetle larvae back in the 90s, I think, when we did that. And it took a number of years. I mean, you know, we're 15 years, 20 years down the road, but we have not seen huge problems with the lily leaf beetle. There's always a small number that's going to be there. But they're not. I'm confident planting lilies these days.
Yeah, a small number, I can deal with that.
Exactly.
It's the when there's a lot of them that it gets depressing.
They destroy the plants and they're disgusting.
Yes. we were talking earlier about the rabbits eating the hosta. The hosta, you mentioned your hosta has come back. At what point, I mean, if they keep chewing on this, there comes a point where it won't bounce back, right?
Well, they ate them fairly early. I have literally hundreds of hostas. I seem to get obsessive about buying them. They ate them early as they were coming up out of the ground. It's like they were these tender shoots just poking up. They hadn't unfurled from that sort of conical little shape that comes up from the root system, and they nibbled them right down. And so they pushed themselves up, and they did leaf out. I do have leaves that, it's only half a leaf, but it's a leaf. And they seem like they'll be fine.
They'll be fine.
The rabbits are no longer feeding them. They seem to like them when they're just coming out of the ground better than when they're mature.
When they're mature, yeah. Let's get Susan in.
I'm not worried about them. I think they'll be fine.
All right. Susan's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just wondering about, I bought a couple of grow boxes. You know those that you're supposed to not have to do much with them, and you can leave them out if it's pouring rain. You don't have to bring, I have a deck garden.
Yep.
So I keep when I know I'm going to have like a day of rain, I have to bring all of the pots that are and the plants are getting bigger and heavier, and I have to bring them all into the porch. So I'm wondering if there are any if you can just leave those grow boxes outside, and if there are any tips that you might have to growing stuff in those boxes.
Yeah. Do they have drainage? Correct.
They have a drainage. Yes.
Yeah.
A little tiny hole.
If there's drainage, that it should be fine left outside.
Okay. Are there any tips to planting stuff in those?
Well, we all have a tendency
to
plant too much in them.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we're so enthusiastic. You know, my daughter has now in her 50s has discovered gardening, and she's very enthusiastic. And she built some raised beds, small, you know, 6 inches tall. And they're probably about 8 feet long, and she just thinks she can plant, you know,
everything,
25 tomatoes in them. I said, no, you can't. You have to space your plants out. So our tendency is to overplant.
Okay.
So I would just avoid doing that.
All right, Susan, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. And Roberta, always great to talk to you. Until next month, thank you. We'll talk to you next month.
Sounds good. Good gardening.
Yep. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.